Sam, keeping it true, watching old movies so you don't have to. With the benefit of hindsight, we'll see where the movies truly are for, or did they change history? Hello and welcome back to the Benefit of Hindsight podcast with me, Sam.
And me, Dean.
The podcast where we watch movies from our past and score them based on our memories, and rewatch them and score them with a new memory to see whether they've changed or lived up to what we remember. You can probably explain that a lot better than I can, so I'm going to take it over to you, Dad.
Oh, I don't know if I can. As Sam says, we revisit movies that we would have watched together in the cinema when Sam was much younger, when he was a kid, and we give them what we call our memory score. And then we give them what we call our rewatch score after we've watched them to see whether or not the movies stand up to our memory. So for some context, I gave, in episode one, I gave The Phantom Menace a score of 2 from memory, but then I upgraded it to a 5 after I'd rewatched it. And Sam, what did you give The Phantom Menace?
I originally gave it a 5 just to be awkward and be right in the middle, but unfortunately after watching it, I ended up giving it a 3 because my opinion definitely changed.
Right. So yeah, so we had a long, long discussion about the Phantom Menace, which you can find in episode 1. But what that means is it actually went up slightly. So our original score was an average of 3.5, and after rewatching it, it went up to a 4. So just by half, and essentially that's my fault. And our next movie is King Kong. But before we get into King Kong, we have had an email. So we had an email from Scott. Yeah, we had an email from Scott. And Scott says, Dear Dean and Sam, enjoyed the podcast. Really enjoyed what you said about The Phantom Menace. Agree with nearly everything that you said. But, and I'll just paraphrase what Scott says here, he went on to say that he actually thought midichlorians was an excellent explanation for the Force. And he goes into a long, long reason why he thinks that is. And ultimately, we've read the email and we disagree with you, Scott. So do continue to email us with your opinions. But yeah, it's really good to get an email. That's our first one. And many thanks, Scott, for that. And yeah, your views on midichlorians are interesting, but we disagree.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting argument there, especially around midichlorians. But interested in hearing other people's opinions all the time. And if you can argue it correctly or against us, then that's fine too. We would love to hear anything and everything. Thank you very much, Scott.
Yeah, and if you do want to email us, the email is thebenefitofhindsightpodcast@gmail.com. It's all one word, all lowercase, thebenefitofhindsightpodcast@gmail.com. So, King Kong. We gave it a score in our last episode. We've gone away and we've watched it again. Sam, what score did you give King Kong from your memory?
So my memory score for this one, I remember liking it quite a lot. And I think we touched upon how many times we think we saw it originally when it came out back in 2005. So my memory score was a 7 out of 10. Because I do remember liking it a lot. I think as a kid there was a lot of moments that I remember being action-packed and very full. And I think there was a time growing up, which was probably more recently than I should admit to, that I realised, as a kid, I just watched a movie and didn't listen to the dialogue or the story that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I would just go and see a big monkey fight dinosaurs and I'd love it. But now growing up, especially doing the podcast with the benefit of hindsight, I'm able to look into the movie and read into it a bit, so understand what the characters are and things like that. So, yeah, my memory score, 7. And
okay,
we'll figure out if it's gone up or down.
Well, I gave it 9. Like you, I did enjoy it. And as you've already alluded to, we did go and see it at the movies more than once. And I really enjoyed it. And actually, also like you, I enjoyed spectacle. And big monkey fighting dinosaurs was right up, right in my wheelhouse, as they say. So yeah, overall, we have given King Kong from memory a score of 16 in total, and therefore 8. It would be our aggregate score. So we've now both watched it. It's nearly 20 years old, would you believe?
Yeah.
My first question is this.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, I was shocked at it. It was so old. My first question is, and don't tell me your score yet, but has your score changed?
It has. See, I was, for the longest time watching it, and that's accurate because it's 3 hours, I was wondering, is my score actually going to change? And it was a bit of a question of how the podcast is going to work, because if my score didn't go up or didn't go down, how does that affect everything overall? But mm-hmm. I can say that it has, in fact, changed.
Wow.
Changed. Mm-hmm. Has yours changed?
I'm going to have to tell you, I don't know. I think the outcome of whether or not my score changes depends a little bit on this conversation. I'm very easily swayed, you know that. So I really don't know at this point whether or not my score has changed, which is a bit of a, it's a bit of a spoiler, isn't it? Because if my score hasn't changed, then you kind of know what I'm thinking.
Be a very interesting podcast if neither of our scores yeah. change. And
so scores changed. We feel the same. Thank you very much for listening. We started when we... go on.
I have a question that I've thought about this a lot while I was watching it. As I've mentioned, it's 3 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to adult Sam, growing up Sam, that's easy. I can sit and watch a 3 hour movie happily and weird like that. How was kid Sam watching a 3 hour movie? Because if we saw it more than once as well, was that one of those kids that just messes around or gets bored easily?
No, absolutely not. No, I was the one that messed around and got bored easily. No, you would sit through a 3 hour movie. We can come back to what I'm about to say in a future episode. But we also went and saw The Two Towers Extended Edition, which I think was about 4 hours long. And you were probably very young. And I was taking you in, and the guy said, it's very long. And I said, he'll be fine. And you sat there for 4 hours and watched it. And so, yeah, in my memory of watching King Kong with you at the cinema was, nope, you sat and you watched it perfectly comfortably on more than one occasion. So, yeah, I did. That's
interesting to know, yeah.
You've brought this up. Let's start with the length of the movie. So it is just over 3 hours, I think, running time of just over 3 hours. You've said you can handle that as an adult, which is great. I had to watch it in two halves. I can't do that anymore.
Admittedly, I did too. But if it was a situation where it was on at the cinema, I would absolutely have done it.
Is it too long?
This is an interesting debate that has happened quite recently as well, and I think it's a bit of a still ongoing one in filmmaking, where films are quite likely to keep being longer.
Mm-hmm.
I know the new Dune film, which came out recently, is about 3 hours long, and some of the newer Marvel ones as well. And I think it depends on how the film is done.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to again compare it to something recent as well. So the new sort of Godzilla versus Kong and Godzilla X Kong, the new Empire, which have come out recently, they're both under 2 hours. And that's the opinion of the director, who says he doesn't like long movies. I could be misquoting that, so you never know. But at the same time, I think it works depending on the movie that you're making. So for those two movies I've just said, you know they're just going to fight, and that's the lead up of the movie. Whereas a 3 hour King Kong movie, especially by Peter Jackson, I'm okay with being 3 hours, because I've sort of, my notes I've done in sort of three parts. So the first hour I noticed was New York, the ship, just get to the island. Mm-hmm. You've not even seen King Kong yet. And I think that works quite well. Then the second part and the third part aren't exactly an hour long, but there's enough in both of them to say, look, this is clearly this part,
yeah.
This is clearly that part. And I think as long as you know your vision and you know what you're doing, 3 hours is perfectly fine. I can't sit and watch a 3 hour movie if you don't know what you're doing.
Mm. Yeah, it's very true.
That's my argument, a very long-winded argument, but that's just how I feel about that.
I agree. I felt something quite similar, which was people who talk about movie making and directors and script writers will always talk about first, second and third act. And sometimes they're telegraphed in movies. Sometimes you can see them, sometimes you can't. But King Kong is definitely a three act movie. So it has, you know, as you said, the ship, getting to the island, on the island, and then... getting back. The length thing, I asked the question because I probably did think it was a bit long. I'm not going to say anything that's particularly original. All the critics said it at the time. Probably you could lose some of the stuff in the second act.
See, that's interesting because I was thinking, what could you actually lose? And I think the second act is where you'd be better off adding things in and losing from the first act instead.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but that's just my opinion.
I might lose a couple of the action sequences where they're really well done, the really good CGI effects, well acted, and we'll come back to cast in a moment. But you have a fight with some dinosaurs, then some dinosaurs running, then some insects attacking, then a fight between King Kong and Godzilla, which, not Godzilla, a Tyrannosaurus Rex. I know that has to stay in. That's essential.
Yeah.
But if you lose one of those sequences, you don't lose any sense of terror on the island.
No, that's true, yeah. I did think, actually, that it's a bit weird that he does fight dinosaurs and then, before you know it, it's just he's fighting the humans now. I feel like there should have been more dinosaur stuff.
Yeah, that's but true.
Again,
yeah.
It just depends on how you do it.
Yeah. The bit in New York, let's go back to the first bit. I was really impressed with that. It's all CG. I'm assuming it's most of it's CGI, the kind of long shots and things. I was really impressed with that. It felt like a really good, I don't know what the right word is. It felt like a really good evocation of what you would expect New York in the 1930s to look like. I thought it was really, really pitched well.
Absolutely, yeah, it was quite convincing. I think I don't see a lot of movies set at that time that sort of go into the whole, there's a name for it, the American something.
The Depression?
Not the American Dream, but that's the one, yeah, the Big Depression.
Great Depression, yeah.
Nailed it. Yeah, where they show just genuinely how awful it was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And not just, and for like different classes of people as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I did quite enjoy it. I think I mentioned on the last one that I think I tried to watch it a few years more recently, and I think I did get stuck getting past that bit because when I'm younger, I want to just get to the action.
Mm-hmm.
But I did have, I don't know if I'm cutting you off here, so if I am, just say.
No, carry on.
If you've got anything else to add? I think for me, the first hour is quite unique in what it actually delivers because it's always been a problem with these sort of, let's say, giant monster movies, where there's either too much human character involvement or occasionally not enough. And I know a lot of fans don't like it when there's too much. So I think doing it as a 3-hour thing with having the first hour be humans,
it
sells the reality of what they're about to do.
Yeah.
And you understand the characters and you get motivated to like see it as it is.
I think what Peter Jackson is good at is telling a storytelling. And if you think about at the time that King Kong was being made, actually, he was still working on Lord of the Rings. So pre-production for King Kong starts whilst post-production is still happening on The Return of the King. And so he's inhabiting this fantasy world. And yet what he's really good at, actually, is storytelling, character, directing actors. And I thought that the human element to the story showed that, the fact that you had all these interactions between the human characters. There's nothing fantastic about it at all. It is heavily CGI, of course, but actually it just showed that when you're a good director and you're working with good actors, you can create something that's actually completely convincing. And I just thought I really enjoyed the interactions between all of the characters. I enjoyed Jack Black and Colin Hanks' interaction, and then Jack Black with Naomi Watts' scene in the restaurant is nicely acted and well made. I did change my opinion on one thing for the better. When we watched the film the first time, I wasn't convinced by Jack Black in the movie.
Right.
Didn't think he had the substance to pull it off. I actually think he's better than I remember him being. What about you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think I'd forgotten that Jack Black was in it until you mentioned it last time, obviously, because I've seen the movie now. And I thought, it's Jack Black. I always see him as a comedy actor, if anything. So I was a bit dreading how bad this was going to turn out. I actually think it was a really good choice. And I quite liked seeing his take on such a serious character like that. And I think he goes through quite... I don't know if it's so much of an arc as I'll say it is, but it's interesting to see where he starts and how he ends.
Yeah.
He even gets the last line as well, which is quite poetic for him, the line that he says. But I definitely... I'm happy with it being him.
Yeah, at the time the movie came out... Yeah, at the time the movie came out, I think it was School of Rock had been out a year or so before that, and that's what he had become quite well known for. Also a good film, actually. But yeah, I there was... Like all of these things, I should write stuff down, but there, in the second act of the movie, his obsession with filming and capturing the island... drives him to this really, really dark place. And I think he played that very well. What do you think of the casting overall then, the cast of King Kong?
Can I just jump quickly back to Jack Black's character?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool, thanks.
You don't have to ask.
Is it a Peter Jackson self-insert? And Peter Jackson has written himself, probably exaggerated, as a character in that movie?
Oh, that's a good question. I hadn't thought of that.
I'm not expecting an answer. Only Peter Jackson could probably answer that. But it's sort of, as a director with a character who is a director, I don't know, it might be one of those where I'm mixing reality, where Jack Black probably watched how Peter Jackson directed and took inspiration. But I just find it quite interesting that it could almost be assumed that it's Jack Black.
That, yeah.
No, Peter Jackson. It's really complicated. But yeah.
Maybe I'm just
grasping at straws.
No, I didn't see that. But now you mention it, actually, I think it might be true. You could certainly make an argument that it is true. Okay. If you think of Peter Jackson's experience as a director and wanting to get films made and being, you know, if you know anything about the way the Lord of the Rings films were made, he had to really fight for that. It was, you know, it was his baby. He fought for it, and it turned out successful. But I can imagine him in meetings with producers where they're worrying about money and they're not seeing anything. So yeah, actually, that's.
I think I heard about that.
Yeah, it's probably a good spot that Peter Jackson has inserted himself into the film in the character of Carl Denham.
Anyway, back to what you're saying.
Yeah, my question was about the cast generally. What did you think of the cast overall?
Interesting, because I haven't really seen a lot of them in a lot of films apart from Jack Black, and maybe Adrian Brody.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, that's where those actors started, of where I recognised them and knew them from. I do think Naomi Watts did a very convincing job towards the end of being like, of recognising that this isn't just a monster, that there's, I don't want to say human behind it, obviously, apart from Andy Serkis. But I don't, the humanity, I think, is probably what I'm looking for, where he's an animal. He's only doing what he knows he's doing. And I think she sells that incredibly well. I think maybe at some point it's a bit weird, but I think you've got to sort of agree with the weirdness of it.
You just fall
for these characters.
You have to go with the weirdness of that bit at the end. One thing I noticed how little she said in the movie. Her actual dialogue in the film is very, very little. It's quite a lot in the first bit where she's, you know, meeting Carl Denham and getting on the boat and, you know, enjoying being with the playwright and things. But in Act 2 and Act 3, she says almost nothing. It's all... it's all in the face, the eyes, the gestures, and the movements that she does. And Peter Jackson is really good at filming eyes.
I'll agree with that.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's a trick in it somewhere. In fact, I know what the trick is, but I don't want to be a massive geek. but
it's interesting as well because he's really good at filming a CGI monster's eyes.
Yeah.
If that's
how
we're describing it.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's something in the eyes. But she tells so much of her story in that film through her eyes. And, I think she's really good in that film. I think that she deserves all the credit in the world for convincingly portraying somebody who is essentially... having a kind of relationship with an animal. And I don't mean that in a kind of odd way. Lots of people have relationships with animals. Lots of people have pets that they love and things. It's not that unusual. But you, in the eyes, everything that she does is just amazing, genuinely amazing. I thought she was very, very good in that. And the cast is a good cast.
My only sort of slight issue at one point was Jamie Bell. I don't think he's actually American, so I think his accent slipped towards the beginning.
Yeah.
And it left me listening quite closely to the rest of his dialogue just to see if it happened too. But it happened.
He's from the northeast of England, like you, right?
Oh, is he? I didn't know that.
Cool. He was in Billy Elliot, wasn't he? He is Billy Elliot. He was in the movie of Billy Elliot, and that's kind of where I knew him from. I thought he was actually pretty good in it. I actually really liked the... very small subplot between him and Hayes. I thought that was really nice. I'd forgotten that Hayes died as well, so that came as a bit of a shock.
I was expecting it.
I had remembered that Andy Serkis died.
I don't know. That bug scene will forever make me so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I remember it being uncomfortable, and rewatching it any time is just like clips and everything is just, I don't like it.
Yeah.
I watched it, but I wouldn't want to be in that situation. No, I'm just glad they weren't giant spiders.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you don't do spiders, do you? No. The bug scene is... you can argue that it's superfluous. I like a lot of these things, but it's creepy. It makes your skin crawl, and they kill Andy Serkis.
And as well, what I did notice about that scene is the music.
Mm-hmm.
At first, it... like for the majority of it, it's so calm.
Yeah.
And it's just this sort of weird juxtaposition, I think, of horrific image with peaceful music. And obviously the music gets more and more intense, but it really caught me off guard. I was like, this is a nice piece of music, but not what I'm watching.
There's an interesting soundtrack anecdote about this movie. I don't know if you know this.
I don't think I do.
Stop me if you do. So the original soundtrack was being written by Howard Shore, who did the music for Lord of the Rings.
And I was quite surprised in the credits that it wasn't him, because I was expecting it because of Lord of the Rings.
And he pulled out of the project, or was pushed out of the project, following what were described as creative differences with Peter Jackson.
Right.
And so they had an almost finished movie and no soundtrack. So they drafted in James Newton Howard. And I don't know the exact amount of time. I can Google it now, but I don't want to. And I'm sure someone somewhere will correct us if we're wrong. But I think he had like 4 weeks to write the entire soundtrack. And so he put the whole thing together in 4 weeks. And
that makes a lot of sense, though.
Uh-huh.
So I'll let you finish that first.
The thought I was going to finish there is, if you listen to the soundtrack, I think soundtrack's really good. I think it's up there with my favourite movie soundtracks of all time. But quite a lot of the themes are the same. They repeat. And they're just played slightly differently. So even when what you said there about the nice, soft, gentle music before the bugs is actually very similar to other themes that repeat later on in the movie. But yeah, it's a good soundtrack inside that. Or even better because it was written... so quickly.
I'm gonna have to disagree.
You don't like the soundtrack?
I didn't enjoy the soundtrack, and I think now I know why. Is because to me it felt like it was incredibly repeated.
Uh-huh.
The first hour it was basically the same song over and over again, and I got quite sick of it.
I think it is.
I mean, there's, don't get me wrong, that it's great music, but it's used a bit too much. I didn't really see enough variation in it. But that's just me.
I wouldn't disagree with you on the sameness of it all. I just think there are moments in that soundtrack that are very, very good. And I'm probably biased by the bit at the end. We haven't really talked about the end of the movie, and we did talk about this in the previous podcast, so I don't really want to keep going on about it, but the ice skating scene in Central Park and the piece of music that plays alongside that, I think that's one of my favourite scenes in any movie of all time, ever.
And now a word from today's sponsor. Are you tired of feeling weak and lacking the strength you need to conquer your goals? Introducing King Kong Muscle Supplements, the ultimate solution to unleash your inner beast. Picture this. You, standing tall, muscles bulging, and the envy of everyone around you. With King Kong Muscle Supplements, you can achieve the physique you've always dreamed of. Our scientifically formulated supplements are designed to maximize your muscle growth and enhance your performance. Whether you're a professional athlete or a fitness enthusiast, King Kong has got you covered. Our secret lies in the powerful blend of natural ingredients, carefully selected to fuel your body and boost your endurance. Say goodbye to fatigue and hello to unstoppable energy. But don't just take our word for it. Listen to what our satisfied customers have to say.
Ever since I started using King Kong Muscle Supplements, my workouts have reached a whole new level. I feel stronger, more focused, and ready to take on any challenge.
I've tried countless supplements before, but nothing compares to King Kong. It's like a beast in a bottle. My gains have skyrocketed, and I've never felt better.
Are you ready to unleash the beast within? Don't wait any longer. Visit our website or call the number on your screen. Wait. This is a podcast, right? To order your King Kong Muscle Supplements today. But hurry, because supplies are limited and this offer won't last forever. Unleash your true potential with King Kong Muscle Supplements. One thing that I do really want to bring up, and we have touched upon it already, the CGI.
Yes.
I think it's frankly amazing for the time, for 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Kong looked real.
Yep.
I'll say all of the fight scenes with the dinosaurs were great. The bugs, although I don't like them, were still also pretty good. However, any time there was an actor or a character on screen with either of those things, even if it's a location, it didn't work.
No.
And I think you could clearly see the seam of
you
where
can see the join.
CGI yep. matches mm-hmm. reality. Yeah, the join. And it kind of put me off for the most part. But apart from that, it was all really good and I really liked it. The thing I will say about the actors and the CGI is that whenever there was a shot that needed a CGI actor, it also worked perfectly mm-hmm. and you couldn't tell the difference. But when it was a real actor with CGI, it didn't work for me at all. Not that it didn't work for me, it just didn't look good.
I think I agree with that. I think that the technology probably has come on over the last 20 years, so you can't see the join. But you can definitely tell the difference between what is a human movement and what is a CGI movement. And but I think that was right at the end of, as we've already said, Lord of the Rings, which was, you know, well ahead of its time, I think, in what was able to achieve in CGI. And this was the next step. And I think there's an element of the movie that is, I'm not going to use the words showing off, because I don't think it is. I think it needs CGI to tell the story. But I think it is a part of the movie is look at what we can do now.
Mm-hmm. And I will also just sort of add to that, to my criticism, is that Peter Jackson uses miniature sets and like actual built set pieces. And I think George Lucas does it, but doesn't get enough credit for it either. So I think I can appreciate using an actual physical thing rather than just a big green room.
Yeah.
And then putting the actors on it. So, I mean, I totally understand how it's happened and why it's happened. And I appreciate the process behind it. And I feel like that's me going back on myself, but it's just,
no,
it's not.
The cast as well, they know they're in a big CGI movie. But you know, I'm going to offer a thought that I think could easily be challenged because I don't really quite know where it's going. But you know, sometimes when you watch a movie and it's heavily CGI, you get a sense that the movie knows it's heavily CGI. And even sometimes the actor's costume has been CGI'd onto them. And the CGI is, it's not extraneous, it's just part of the storytelling. But what I liked about the cast and the actors in this was that although they know they're in a big budget CGI blockbuster movie, they never ever lost. And there was no sense that they were overawed by what they were doing. They acted each scene in a human way really, really well. But the actual drama storytelling of the movie by the actors, I thought was really, really well done. It might be one of the best combinations I can remember seeing of really, really good acting.
No, I agree with that.
A heavily CGI'd blockbuster movie.
Absolutely, yeah. I don't know if that's because it's due to it being quite early on in that tradition. Mm-hmm. So it's less of a concern for actors, let's say.
Yeah.
But it definitely, they sold it and it worked well, I think, yeah.
Yeah, that's the way to say it. They absolutely...
I think with those kinds of things, as you've kind of said anyway, there's an element of realism that they need to deliver to the audience as well. And if that isn't there and it's missing, the audience is never going to believe it. So, yeah.
What about then the third act? It isn't quite an hour, but the third act of the movie. So I'm going to, you know, in the last podcast we said let's not talk about midichlorians because there's loads of theories and things. And then Scott emailed and talked to us about midichlorians. So the thing that we shouldn't say in this podcast so we get an email about it is how do they get King Kong to New York? So we're not going to talk about that because that's what everybody says.
I remembered a scene that showed that, but I don't know why I've remembered that. So never mind. I made it up to fill the gap.
You see him, he's on the chloroform, and the next thing you see is on a stage in New York, and the boat didn't seem big enough.
No.
So, but that Peter Jackson did say, yeah, we could have showed that, but we didn't want to because they didn't do that in the original one, which is, I thought, fair enough. So if you want to email with your view on that, then Peter Jackson said they didn't do it because the original doesn't do it. But
and if
you
Peter
get
Jackson then, wants to email and let us know, then please do.
Yeah, Peter Jackson, feel free to do so. He probably will.
Definitely.
And we emailed about the last one. Couldn't get rid of him.
Under the pen name Scott.
The third act is I like the third act. Monster loose on the streets of a city trope. I like that.
No comment. No, yeah, I think.
Do you not like it?
I have a history. Just cut that joke out.
No, we need to keep that in. We keep that in, and we can come back to it when we should have a running podcast joke.
Yeah.
But just we're going to keep this bit in. When I'm gonna, can I share this with our listeners?
Go for it. Yeah, it's only it has to.
Yeah, we have to share this at some point. I watched Cloverfield when it came out. I can't remember the exact year that was, but you were quite young, and I thought, Sam would like that. It's a bit scary at times, but you'll really enjoy that, and you're good at scary things. You'd seen scary things before, like King Kong.
Did
example.
I?
Well, it's in King Kong. That's full of scary monsters and a big monkey. So Sam and I sat and watched Cloverfield, and I think I ruined your childhood.
Yeah, scarred for life. Still scarred for life. I've never gone back to it. And if I think about it, my palms get sweaty.
Will we watch Cloverfield as part of the Benefit of Hindsight podcast?
There's a chance. If we get enough listeners and enough people asking
let's do a Twitter poll.
I'll give it a
yes
go.
Or no.
I'll film my reaction and everyone can see how traumatized I am.
Yeah. So when I say I like monsters loose in cities, I guess you have a little minor nervous breakdown inside, yeah?
A little bit. But it's interesting. Sorry, what were you going to say then?
No, I was just going to say I ruined your childhood with Cloverfield and somebody ruined mine with An American Wolf in London, so... I know how you feel.
It's generational. I'll have to ruin my kids with a movie at some point.
It is.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, though, how I was traumatized by that, but things like King Kong, I wasn't. Mm-hmm. And in later years, I've watched Godzilla and things like that, and I love them. So, like, what was it about Cloverfield? And I think I know what it was, and I know I'm getting completely sidetracked here, but it's the shaky cam. Whereas, I know it kind of happens in King Kong and things like that, but I think when I can see that it's clearly fake and, I mean, well acted, then it's fine. Yeah. And I think with the big monkey, I can just enjoy it because I can go and buy the toy.
Yeah, that's true. You go out and buy the big King Kong toy. Anyway, we'll come back to Cloverfield, but we'll do a Twitter poll.
Please don't.
and if you do want us to rewatch Cloverfield, and then let us know. It'd be really cruel if you did that. But
anyway. I might just pretend that I did and watch a Pixar movie instead.
You talk about that. The third act. Let's get back onto that. The big monkey moment. Did you like it? I mean, what did you think of the third act?
I think it's quite interesting because it's clearly sticking to the source material of the original one, because I'm sure that happens anyway. But obviously with the new technology and things like that, they're able to improve on it. And I've really liked it. Do you know what it is as well? I really like the fact that Kong is clearly motivated. He's not just, I'm going to destroy a city. He's looking for Anne, and he'll pick any blonde lady up.
Yeah.
At that point, everyone runs to go and dye their hair. I would. but I found it quite interesting just to see that. And even Adrian Brody's character, which is Jack, isn't it? I'm sure it is.
Yeah.
I definitely watched the movie. Because it's Jack Black and him. I thought it was quite interesting. Yeah, that's right. And he takes it upon himself to sort of save everyone. It kind of takes on the hero role. That's another really interesting thing that I found with this time around. But even the taxi driver, who just, it's all yours, and he jumps out, and then Jack just tries to get everyone to safety. It's not the greatest plan in the world, and apparently New York is really small because he just bumps into Anne along the way.
Absolutely.
But I really liked how realistic it was with the action, with everyone being terrified, Kong being motivated, and each character just having their own sort of, like, motivation's not the right word, but they had their own thing going on, like something to do. Except maybe Carl, who just clearly looks defeated in the theatre and then turns up later on. Because again, New York is really small. But no, for me, it absolutely worked, and it totally sold the movie. And I'm rambling quite a lot, but I think as well as seeing Kong outside of his own environment and how he deals with a completely different world, up to the whole ice skating bit as well. I think it would be lost if we didn't have that third act in the actual movie.
I would definitely agree.
That was a lot of information.
But I would agree with what you've said. I think it is a really good, everything you said. There's that you've got your classic hero, you have your classic leading lady, you have the big monster running around. You've got the defeated bad guy, which I guess would be Carl Denham. I wanted to say something about the character of Anne Darrow and her humanity. And you mentioned humanity before, and there's a real juxtaposition, if I'm allowed to use that word, between her innate innate humanity and affection for the animal and the rest of humanity that's just trying to destroy it because it simply doesn't understand it. And I think that's a point that's absolutely crucial to make, is that ultimately nobody really, apart from Anne, comes out of the movie very good. I suppose Adrian Brody's character comes out of it quite well. He's heroic. He obviously is also fond of Anne. But at the end of it, you just get a sense that nothing's changed. You know, from the time the movie was first made in the 1930s to when it comes out in 2005, nothing's changed. Humanity is keen to destroy anything it doesn't understand.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
All the Beast wants, if you like, it's the classic Beauty and the Beast story. All the Beast wants is to be with a person or individual that he wants to spend time with. So that's why the ice skating scene is so good, so important, because it tells that side of the story. And you know, Kong effectively sacrifices himself for somebody. And then at the end, you get all the people kind of standing around him, taking photographs, and the brave policeman who didn't do anything. You know, we defeated it. And then, you know, Denham's classic line, 'twas beauty killed the beast, is probably true. But But it's also not true. It's also ironic. It wasn't beauty that killed the beast. It was fear of the beast, but which represents, in my view, fear of the unknown. So that's the only thing I would say. There is a sense of humanity in it, but the humanity is that humanity isn't actually very nice.
Yeah, and I think as well, there's a lot of like the childlike innocence of it all. And Harry's just been brought up to a new world and just wants... You could argue it's like a motherly figure as well.
Yep. For Anne. Yeah, there's genuine affection between them, and I think that's, as I said before, I think that's the hardest thing to capture, because you can argue that it's weird, okay? You it's just weird, but it isn't. It just works because it's well played, and you're just happy to suspend your disbelief at that moment. I read something on the internet. You should never read things on the internet, and it was somebody talking about King Kong, and they were criticizing the end of the movie. At the end of the movie, when Jack climbs to the top of the Empire State Building, they literally stood right on top of it. Kong's now fallen off to his death, and they have the hug right on the top of the Empire State Building.
Brave hug.
and this person on the internet had said, "Oh, how that was dangerous, and why was it not windy, and why did they? Where were they? They could fall off." And I thought, if you watch 3 hours of King Kong, and at the end of it, you're thinking that people might fall off. You may have missed the point of this movie. A big monkey's just fallen to its death. Don't worry. And stuff like that makes me laugh. It actually makes me laugh when people talk about things like, oh, it's not realistic, whatever. Well, it's not realistic. It's a fantasy movie. But in this case, it's a fantasy movie that tells a very, very human story, beautifully realised and directed by Peter Jackson.
Yeah. And I think that makes it work. Not just as a movie that you'd go and see at the cinema, but just as a... I think it... If I was able to choose, I'd put it among some of like the top films of the last however many years, just because of its ability to tell a story with emotion and be convincing, on top of the whole decent script with brilliant CGI, yeah. I think that's a pretty good conclusion, actually. But yeah.
Yeah, one more summary to add, and that is this. I texted you yesterday and said it was, I can't remember the exact words, like a deeply problematical movie or something.
Yeah.
And you said, the deeply problematic, this is really my final point. So the reason why it's deeply problematical is it isn't really. Whatever you think of that type of film, whether you like the action, the bigness of it all, whatever you think, the last 30 minutes of that film will make you feel differently about it.
Absolutely. I can completely agree with that.
You could watch a three-hour film and the last 30 minutes will make you come away thinking, that was amazing. So even if you don't like all the Skull Island stuff, even if that's not your thing, at the end of the movie you will say, that's amazing. And that, for me, then, is deeply problematical in terms of my score. But over to you, because you had something you wanted to say.
No, I just wanted, before we get into the whole score thing and like the in-depth opinion, I just wanted to say, if I had a nickel for every time Kyle Chandler was in a movie with a big CGI monkey, I'd have 2 nickels, which isn't a lot, but it's weird that it happened twice.
That is true, yeah. Yeah,
I didn't. That is true. I had to double check that it was him. It's really weird, but yeah.
Yeah, that's, he's good in that. He's really good in that. He's good in the movie, actually. We should have given him a shout out. I think Carl Chandler's really good in it. I also think we have mentioned Andy Serkis, but we probably should mention just how good he is as Kong. When you think that's a CGI, sort of human CGI thing, that he's really good at that. And I actually really liked Billy Elliot. He was really sympathetic.
Jamie Bell, yeah,
that's the one. I didn't notice his accent slip.
Maybe it wasn't, because I'm not very good at that kind of thing, but still, yeah.
I'll go back.
There was one
check.
Thing I wanted to say about Andy Serkis. And why did he choose his character? I don't know if he chose it, but why did he have one eye closed for the majority of the movie? There's nothing wrong with it. When they're on the ship and it's crashing, he opens it. So it's just like, it's a weird choice.
It is a weird choice. I don't know.
Give him an eye patch, if anything.
Yeah, maybe that's what... Maybe he's Popeye. Popeye spends quite a lot of time with his eyes closed and is famously
Popeye
a sailor.
Popeye self-insert character.
Maybe he is. Maybe he is Popeye, because he also... Popeye famously has an eye closed and is always smoking. As is... So maybe he's based his character on Popeye. If you know, you know where we are. You can email us, thebenefitofhindsightpodcast@gmail.com. Is Andy Serkis channeling his inner Popeye in King Kong. We deal with the big questions. That's the kind of insight we deliver in our podcast.
Yeah. Make sure to listen for more insightful comments.
Tune in next week as we discuss many other insightful things. So I was going to ask you for your score. Do you want me to go first?
I'm happy to go first. I went first last week, I think, so it's up to you.
I'll go first this week. Okay, so I gave it a 9 from memory and have indicated over the years that it might be my favourite film. So I have high expectations of it. I realised as I was watching the movie that some of the longer action sequences have lost their charm as I've got older.
Right. Okay.
But the ending of the movie was much, much more powerful than I remember it from 20 years ago. So if I was judging the movie, this is why it's problematical. If I was judging the movie without the last 30 minutes, I would go down. I would go down. Okay. But I think the last half an hour of the film is so good that it saves the movie.
I was going to say like a saving grace kind of thing. Yeah,
exactly. It saves the movie. And I came away from the movie thinking, no, I still love it every bit as much as I did. And that's all because of, I think, Naomi Watts. I think she's awesome in it. So I am going to stick with 9 because I would otherwise go down, but for the saving grace of the end. So my new review of the movie is I could watch Act 1 and Act 3 and give it a 10. But if I watch Act 1, Act 2 and Act 3 together, it's a 9. So it stays the same for different reasons. But it's definitely up there, I think, with one of my most favourite movies of all time. So I'm sticking with 9.
Wow, that's a really interesting take, yeah. I genuinely, the way you were talking, I thought you were going to bring it down, but fair enough. I can't really argue. So I'd given it a 7 out of 10, and I did kind of hint at the beginning that I wasn't sure if I was also going to change it, but I have changed it. And I think after discussing it, I'm quite happy that I did change it. So overall, I really enjoyed it. We strangely got very invested. I forgot we were watching it for a podcast, which is a good thing. I'm happy to do that.
Yeah, it's good, yeah.
And I got invested in the character moments and the action sequences, but that's just me, still being a kid, apparently. I got invested in the story that they were telling and all the characters and motivations and whatnot. As I've said, the 3-hour runtime, not a problem to me, and I've explained that, and I'll stick by that. As long as the movie is good, I'm happy to sit for as long as I need to. And I do think it's aged well enough, with the exception of the CGI on the humans. That being said, my score from original 7 has gone up to an 8 out of 10.
Oh, wow. And okay.
Like I say that, I almost kept it at 7, but I think I'm quite happy with saying that I like this movie enough to put it as an 8. What more can you really do? So
I think we've settled on a good score because that gives us an overall average of 8.5.
Okay.
And cool. I think if you're going to make a podcast of which you rank films and you score them out of 10, 8.5 would tend to suggest good movie, and then we'd agree with that. It also tells us that we think it's twice as good as The Phantom Menace, which I think it probably is.
True. Yeah.
Okay. That's King Kong. Our next movie on the Benefit of Hindsight podcast. What is it, Sam?
So it feels a bit like a big leap from the two that we've already watched so far, but I think that's a good thing because it is just the history of everything that we saw, or almost everything, not Cloverfield.
Not Cloverfield.
We'll see. Everything that we saw when I was younger. And this is a movie that I've always sort of held quite dear and close to me for a while. And it is the 2011 film, Martin Scorsese film actually, Hugo.
Yeah, I do remember, like you, really liking it when we watched it. I don't think we watched it twice. I did think I bought the book. I went out and bought the book. I remember being quite moved by it, really enjoying it. It's quite gentle, well directed. It's Martin Scorsese, but I don't actually remember that much about it.
Right. I think on occasion it's something that I forget about too, and what it's deeply about. Because I think even going into it originally, having no knowledge of it, I did not expect what I came out with.
No.
And to me, Martin Scorsese was just a name back then, and now obviously I understand his impact and things like that. But I think looking back on that movie, I've kind of grown up with it in the sense that it was about film and how that started. And now, having been a film student, so I'm used to not learning anything, I hold that film quite close, is what I'm trying to say. And I don't want to give anything away because I think I've got a lot that I can say. I'm looking forward to it.
We probably spoke too long about King Kong in the last podcast in our introduction to it. I certainly did. So my brief recollection of Hugo would be that it's very moving. It's really well acted. There's a really, really good cast. You definitely enjoyed it. You were spellbound by it. I didn't realize that it had become quite personal about the fact that you then sort of later went into film. I thought that was something else, interestingly enough. The things that you learn when you do a podcast with your son.
I don't know if it's exactly credited for me being a film student, but I think looking back on it, it could be.
Yeah, yeah. It would certainly be about the time that you were sort of, you know, secondary school age, thinking about what you might be doing. It was a flop. Didn't make any money, did it? It was a flop.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My memory score for Hugo is, I'm going to go straight in, I'm going to go 6. And the reason why I'm going 6 is because this is actually one that I'm really looking forward to watching again, because I do remember really liking it. I remember you really liking it, but I don't remember that much about it. So I can't say it's a 10, it's a 1. I just remember liking it. So it's going to be better than the middle score by memory. I'm going to give it a 6, and I'm really looking forward to going away and watching it and talking about it next week.
My score, keeps being a bit, it's almost as if I'm repeating myself each week. But for this one, I'm going for an 8 out of 10.
Okay.
And that makes me a bit nervous for it going down. But I think I'd be okay with it going down, I suppose. But I do love that movie. I do hold it personally. It's 8 out of 10 from me. And that's what I'll keep it at.
So we have an overall Hugo score of 7.
Okay. I'm happy with that.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty strong. So if you want to comment on anything that we've said in the podcast this week, you can get in touch with us via our socials. We're on Twitter at TBO Hindsight Pod, and of course email that we said already, thebenefithindsightpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks to Scott for emailing us. So far we have to keep saying you, Scott. You're the only person that has. Hopefully more people will email us.
Yeah, thanks, Scott.
And we'll definitely give you a shout out. And we look forward to doing this again next week. Thanks for listening. Keep an eye out for our next episode, where we'll be talking about watching Hugo. We're out every Monday on all available podcast platforms. So that would then be a goodbye from me.
And a goodbye from me too.
And see you next episode.
Hindsight, we'll see, were the movies truly awful, or did they change history?